You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Okay, another passage from Romans. And as I mentioned last week, Romans is unique among the seven authentic Pauline letters in that it's the only one written to people not a part of a church Paul started or who Paul knew personally. Another unique aspect of Romans is not just that Paul closes the letter with an introduction of his emissary who's delivering it, but that the messenger is a woman. Her name is Phoebe, and Paul refers to her as a deacon and basically says, "I'm expecting you people to do right by her." So, not only is Paul basically phoning ahead and saying, "Get your act together before I arrive," his messenger is part of the message. More on that later. Our passage today is in the middle of Paul's argument that the Romans are all in this life together, and they should knock off the judgments of one another. Here's what's at issue. There were lots of new Christians joining the movement, in part because the Christian gatherings were centered around meals. And when hunger is an issue the way it was in ancient Rome, it's not surprising that such a religious group would be popular. The other reality is that for those who could afford it, pagan temples basically functioned as the local butcher. Once animals were sacrificed and the priests took the meat that they wanted, the rest was sold in the market. But here's the rub. It was meat that had been sacrificed to idols. So confusion arose because more mature Christians could look at the meat and say, whichever so-called god this meat was sacrificed to, doesn't really matter, doesn't exist. So this is just meat. But the freshly minted Christian in their midst, trying to make the break from paganism, was thinking, now, wait a second here. How can you eat meat that is dedicated to the god so-and-so? Likewise, with different days being honored, do you worship on Saturday, the Jewish Sabbath, or on Sunday, the day dedicated to the pagan sun god? So, lots of unrest and confusion. Who better to jump in and straighten it all out than Paul? Anyway, written sometime around 56 to 58 from Corinth, here's Paul's solution.
Our words of wisdom today are from Romans 14, verses 1 through 8. Welcome those who are weak in faith, but not for the purpose of quarreling over opinions. Some believe in eating anything, while the weak eat only vegetables. Those who eat must not despise those who abstain. And those who abstain must not pass judgment on those who eat, for God has welcomed them. Who are you to pass judgment on servants of another? It is before their own Lord that they stand or fall, and they will be upheld, for the Lord is able to make them stand.
Some judge one day to be better than another, while others judge all days to be alike. Let all be fully convinced in their own minds. Those who observe the day, observe it in honor of the Lord. Also, those who eat, eat in honor of the Lord, since they give thanks to God, while those who abstain, abstain in honor of the Lord and give thanks to God.
We do not live to ourselves, and we do not die to ourselves. If we live, we live to the Lord. And if we die, we die to the Lord. So then, whether we live or whether we die, we are the Lord's. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Look, you all have heard me tell this joke before, but you remember someone once asked their rabbi, why is it that rabbis always answer a question with another question? The rabbi answers, so what's wrong with a question? Right? So Jesus was a typical rabbi of his day. According to the canonical Gospels, He rarely gave a straight answer to a question. Instead, he responded with another question, or he told a story. Rather than offer his disciples answers to life's most perplexing problems, Jesus essentially put his hearers in a position of having to think for themselves. For the most part, Jesus was not offering simple answers, which is good because simple or rigid answers are often brittle and don't tend to age well over time. In fact, absolute certainty can often create a false sense of security and become a barrier to developing one's own awareness of the divine. In our passage today, lots of people had lots of ideas of how to do Christianity. Eating meat sacrificed to idols or not? What day do we honor as Sabbath? And I love Paul's answer. Get over it. There are lots of ways for lots of people. Just make sure whatever you do, Paul says, let all be convinced in their own minds. Okay, then. There are lots of different ways to be a follower of Jesus, and lots of different beliefs within the bounds of Christianity. Different denominations are influenced by different cultures, and different expressions of being a follower of Jesus are driven by any number of uniquely local traditions. Where the problem comes in is when being convinced in our own minds is then projected onto everyone else as the ultimate end-all and be-all answer. If you don't believe, act, or express your Christianity in exactly this way or that, then you're out. But our own John Wesley wrote, "Beyond the basics of being in relationship with Jesus, everything else is just opinion." And that's where we as the United Methodist Church have a great opportunity to witness to the world. For many, church is about hunkering down and defining and defending various beliefs and practices as correct. But one of the characteristics that has defined the Methodist movement for generations is to move with the times and let go of stuff that either doesn't work anymore or that we've decided no longer reflects the best expression of what Jesus was on about. These are the opening credits of one of my favorite movies, Inherit the Wind. And I love Ernest Gold's ominous arrangement of the 19th century hymn, Give Me That Old Time Religion. It really sets the tone for what is a retelling of 1925's Scopes Monkey Trial. It sets up the dramatic disparity between established science and that old-time religion that still exists to this day, and arguments over whether masks are an effective precaution against a global pandemic or not. As a music goob, I can't help but point out that Christians who love the song, That Old-Time Religion, are probably unaware that nowhere does it mention Jesus or the gospel, which I think is one of the reasons that Pete Seeger added some new lyrics that beg the question, if you really want old-time religion, how far back do you want to go? Let us worship Zarathustra just the way we used to. I'm a Zarathustra booster. He's good enough for me. How about, let us worship Aphrodite. She's beautiful but flighty. She doesn't wear a nightie, but she's good enough for me. So basically, no matter what people claim is their idea of old-time religion, it's likely to just be an expression of religion that they've subjectively decided they feel comfortable with and don't want to think about it anymore. If we're honest, where we're at as American Christians today, no matter where you're at on the spectrum, is nothing like what old-time American religion looked like 50 years ago, let alone 100 or 200 years ago. We're all continually moving and evolving away from whatever our parents' or grandparents' idea of religion was. And that's the way it's always been. Let's go back to the messenger who took Paul's letter to the Romans. People are often confused about Paul's attitude towards women. Scholars agree that the quote from Corinthians that women should be silent in churches is not Paul, but in fact was written by someone later and dropped in the text, trying to sync the real Paul with the writings of the author of Timothy, who was pretending to be Paul to get his misogynistic message taken more seriously. Part of the proof of that is right in chapter 16 of Romans, where Paul not only introduces Phoebe, the bearer of this letter, as a leader in the church in Senecre, the port of Corinth, but refers to her as a deacon. Remember, as a rule, women in the first century were chattel. If they had any worth at all, it was for what lands or titles being married to them could bring a man. And yet, here was Paul entrusting a woman with not only leadership in the church, but carrying his letter to the churches of Rome, reading it to them, and explaining it to the people. This is huge. Fast forward to the 18th century, and John Wesley was being scolded for putting women in charge of churches and various meetings. In one case, he was taken to task for letting a woman preach, which was not allowed in the Anglican Church. And he wrote back to the offended party and explained that she was not preaching, she was exhorting scripture. So anytime you hear someone pontificating about how women shouldn't be ordained or have leadership in the church, which includes many churches right in our town, you can just gently slide them over into whatever your mental category is for people who don't know what they're talking about. That's some old-time religion I can do without. When we built our first labyrinth on our campus, I remember there were some who objected, saying, "Isn't that pagan?" To which the proper response is, absolutely, exactly like Christmas and Easter, equally pagan in their origins. But Christianity has a habit of adopting things for our own purposes and making them a part of our heritage. But if we close our minds and get stuck in old ruts, we can be in danger of missing out on all kinds of ways to speak of the Spirit and tell the story of Jesus. You may have heard me talk about Phyllis Tickle's metaphor, where she said that every 500 years or so, the church has a giant rummage sale. We basically need to go through all our old stuff and decide what to keep and what to get rid of. 1,500 years ago, we added the creeds, of which I'm not a big fan. Neither was John Wesley. And it's long overdue for them to go. It was only 1,000 years ago that we added blood atonement. Also, not a big fan. Ready to put that one out on the curb, too. And 500 years ago, it was the Reformation, when we divvied up a bunch of territories and cultures and assigned them to different competitive belief systems. Today, well, for the last 50 years or so, Christianity has been in the midst of what you could call another Reformation that is not only radically readjusting what faith looks like in modern culture, but shedding millions of adherents around the world. Phyllis Tickle went on to say that she's not certain what Christianity is going to look like in the next 50 years, or even how many churches will be left by the end of the 21st century. But one thing is for certain. We need to sell off a bunch of stuff. It's just cluttering up our space and making us irrelevant to younger generations. If you think the church deserves a place in our culture going forward? This is high-stakes stuff. 100 years ago, in the early 1920s, Harry Emerson Fosdick said, "We train our young people to use all of their faculties in their field of study to further the frontiers of knowledge and understanding 6 days a week, but on Sunday, discourage that same practice. Unless we help them think through their faith with their whole minds, we'll lose a whole generation." Those were prophetic words. And let's be honest. The church of many of our upbringings, that old-time religion of the 1950s and 1960s, was often more concerned about maintaining the status quo of white middle-class America than it was of calling out the racism and injustice at work everywhere in our society. Many of you personally remember the turmoil around the civil rights work of Dr. King and others during that time. But do you remember what your own local church was doing? Racist pastors in our own denomination preached things like, "Any accurate reading of the Bible should make it clear that integration goes against the plain truth of the Word of God," and "The right of segregation is clearly established by the Holy Scriptures, both by precept and example." Now that's some old-time religion for you. We have a history right here in Arizona where some of our most outstanding pastors in the United Methodist tradition came here because of their so-called radical social views. A number of them were serving in the South in the 1960s and spoke out against segregation. The threats against them and their families from their own church people became so intense that they had to escape for their own safety. The bishop of the CALPAC conference, of which we were then a part, said, "If you've got to escape somewhere, we'll make a place for you here." Some of our largest and most vital Arizona churches were founded by some of these outspoken pastors. But as MLK himself said, "The human spirit does not move without great difficulty against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom and in the surrounding world." That apathy of conformist thought has crippled many people's ability to see the church's complicity in not only misogynistic and racist values, but in upholding such outdated worldviews that cripple the church's ability to be relevant to many today. Back in 2013, we were fortunate to have Reverend Bruce Sanguine as our special guest preacher for Evolution Sunday. A number of young people from the Baptist church in town showed up to hear what Bruce had to say about this evolutionary Christianity. After the Q&A, I overheard one of them saying to Bruce, "Well, if there's no hell to scare me into being good and no special reward of a Christian's only heaven, then why should I be a Christian? What's my motivation?" And Bruce answered, freedom? I mean, you're liberated from fear of punishment or the promise of reward to simply do good because it's the right thing to do, because you're doing what Jesus taught. Oh, I regularly have to stop and think about how amazing the Fountains is as a faith community. We long ago set aside the expectation that everyone had to toe the line and believe exactly the same thing. We made putting love first our primary concern and, in principle, freed ourselves from the shackles of doing things just because that's the way it's always been done. We opened our doors to interfaith dialogue and engagement when other churches considered it to be heresy. We publicly declared ourselves open and affirming of our LGBTQ neighbors when other churches decried our welcome as misguided and immoral. We've continued to advocate for the embrace of science with annual Evolution Sundays and other events that embrace reality. We're not afraid of changes in theology, practice, and priorities based on working through what putting love first looks like right here and right now. So today, we find ourselves at yet another challenging fork in the road. The challenges of doing church during a pandemic has motivated us to rapidly up our online game in a way that has already proved to have way more positive results than we could have ever imagined just a few months ago. Over the summer, our viewership of this Sunday morning studio celebration has been over 3 times, sometimes close to 5 times, the number of people who would have normally been physically in the pews that day, if we had pews. Plus, there's every indication that our connection to our seasonal family around the country has been much more consistent over the last few months than in previous years. With that in mind, we come to the possibility of coming back to in-person meetings sometime in the future. I'm not going to even say near future, because even though we may be meeting some downward benchmarks in the overall trend of the pandemic, the word we hear from many people is that they're not ready to come back quite yet. But as we move forward, it's time for us to do some dreaming and imagining of what church will look like in the future. And now is not the time to think about little tweaks around the edges. We need to challenge ourselves to think about possibilities that we've never considered before. How can we both be most effective, relevant, and reach people that we've never reached before? To that end, I encourage you to watch your email. If you're on our eStreams mailing list, you'll be receiving an online survey in the next week or so that asks a number of questions about where we're at right now. I encourage you to sit down and answer the questions and give us your opinion so we have a baseline from which to start putting together future options for how the Fountains will move into a new future. Here's the reality. The vast majority of people under 40 in this country believe that Christianity is judgmental, homophobic, anti-science, and irrational. And while that may indeed describe a lot of churches, it does not describe the Fountains. Our challenge is to build on our already established reputation. We have a huge opportunity before us. And the only thing that's standing in our way is that old-time religion. Mary Magdalene and Jesus faced it. Phoebe and Paul faced it. Mary Bosanquet Fletcher and John Wesley faced it. Bishop Karen Olivito is still facing it, along with countless other unnamed saints who have worked to overcome the apathy of conformist thought and the liberation to do what Jesus taught in ways that you may not have ever thought about before. Even before the pandemic, I'm guessing that the way we did Sunday mornings at the Fountains is different than what you remember growing up with. It certainly is for me. Bishop Yvette Flunder has said, "In most of our churches, we have a funeral for Jesus every Sunday. It's just safer that way." What do we do at a funeral? We sing a couple of the deceased's favorite songs, we read familiar texts that make us feel good, and say, "Wow, what a great guy." That is a lot safer than unleashing the creativity, the imagination, and the minds of the people sitting right there in the pews. Look out. Listen, I'm usually not one to quote C.S. Lewis. He's really kind of a poster child for old-time religion for me. But there's one scene in his allegory, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, that really is to my point. When Mr. Beaver, tells Susan that Aslan, the ruler of Narnia, is a great lion. She's surprised and frightened. She says, "I shall feel rather nervous about meeting a lion," and asks Mr. Beaver if Aslan is safe. To which Mr. Beaver replies, "Safe? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe. But he's good." Ah, that's what I hope we can go for. Always good, but never safe. A 17-year-old boy was worshiping in the cathedral at Pisa and noticed a chandelier swinging from the lofty roof. He noticed that no matter how big the ark, it always consumed the same amount of time. He timed it with his own pulse. He started to think about if he could create a pendulum which, swinging like the chandelier, could be some use to humanity. It led to his discovery of laws that regulated the movement of the planets and sent the church into a tizzy. That boy was Galileo, and he was only forgiven for his radical ideas a few years ago. New ways to celebrate, new ways to connect with one another, new ways to engage with a larger community, intentionally leaving behind that old-time religion. If we're going to be good, my hunch is that it may not seem safe to some of us. But who said anything about safe? Putting love first has never been safe, but it's always good. May the Spirit be with us as we go.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.